Well, it's a new year. It's also the 11th day of Christmas, so we're still in the Christmas season here, and it's a natural time to be thinking about resolutions. I have, in the last week, run into, I think, three different people who, this is an odd thing about my occupation, sometimes people instantly feel shame in my presence, especially if they haven't been to church in a while, and then the excuses start coming. And, you know, I was able to remind them that if you come to church this Sunday, you have a perfect attendance in worship for 2026. It's difficult making a resolution. It's difficult to actually live into it. We have the best intentions, and then it's hard to get there. We know that we all need changes. That's why New Year's resolutions are such a big thing. And, you know, I went online and I just looked up, like, typical lists of resolutions, and these are the kind of things. You could guess this right away. I'm going to exercise more. I'm going to eat better, have a healthy diet. I'm going to save more money this year and spend less. I'm going to be happier. I thought that was an interesting one. Like, I'm going to will myself into happiness. Or I'm going to spend more time with friends and with family. And then I came across this tidbit of, you know, internet wisdom about it. It described a man who for multiple years said, I'm going to be healthier as a New Year's resolution, and it never happened. And then he changed the way he said it one year, and he said, I'm going to walk for 20 minutes after dinner each day. And then it stuck. And the point was that clarity was needed, not just effort alone. And that little wisdom thing said this: vague resolutions tend to inspire, but concrete ones tend to transform. So the vague kind of general inspires, but it's when you get into the concrete things that's where the change really happens. Now, I bring that up because I'm hoping that as we look at the story of the wise men, the account of these magi, we'll find a little bit of both. We'll find some concrete things, but we'll also find inspiration there. So that's where I'm headed today. And we're in Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, the story of the wise men. Now, every preacher, myself included, loves to get past Christmas Eve and then blow up all the pageants. Pageants do us no favors because they conflate the story, they confuse details, and pageants are great, by the way, but there are some problems. Even the song that we just sang, it does catechize, it teaches something. We three kings of Orient are. Well, there weren't three. We don't know that. There were three gifts. They're not kings. They're magi, which is a different thing. They were not actually at the birth. When you read the story, it says, when they got to Bethlehem, they found the child and his mother in the house. Joseph was probably off at work, and it's even a different word. It's not the word for infant. It's the word for more like toddler, a small child. So a lot of time has elapsed here. Now, what are magi? Magi were not kings. They weren't rulers in that sense. They were likely from Persia, although they could have been Arabian. We don't know. Speculation here. They were some kind of courtiers. They were among the king's court of their area. They were highly educated. They were like political consultants to the king. They were very dialed into contemporary events. They were also watching celestial signs. They were following current trends. They were wise people, hence we call them wise men. Now, it's a little bit odd, and it can seem folklorish to think that these kind of people would just pick up and would travel all this way and then bring these gifts, and it starts to feel childish, like the pageant. And yet, I think this actually happened. I don't think it's beyond reason that they would have even gone. Aside from the miraculous components, there is some historical stuff worth paying attention to. For instance, the historian Tacitus, writing only a couple of decades after Jesus, tells of, quote, a firm persuasion that at this very time, meaning the time of Jesus' birth, at this very time, the East was to grow powerful and rulers coming from Judea were to acquire universal empire. Tacitus wrote that in his book called Histories. And there are similar things that were written by Josephus, the Jewish historian, and Suetonius, the Roman historian. So I'm not necessarily talking about a messianic prophecy. There was just some kind of a sense, I don't know where it came from, that some great ruler is going to emerge out of Judea. that was kind of known and talked about in that time. And so if you're somebody who's studying the stars, looking for meaning in the, you know, the celestial things, and something unusual happens, you could think, well, here it is. Especially if you're well-read and studied other cultures like the Magi would have done. There's even a prophecy in the book of Numbers about a star rising. It's in Numbers 24, 17. It says, a star will come out of Jacob, which is also Israel. A scepter will rise out of Israel. So a star, a scepter, some kind of a ruler, like that prophecy connects specifically with a celestial thing. And if you do a little bit of the, you know, the astrology or astronomy research, there were three big things that happened just before, about 7 BC. They're actually dates, May 29th, October 3rd, December 4th, where Jupiter and Saturn aligned in such a way that it created a very bright thing. It happened again later, and Kepler wrote about it in his journal. It was so impressive. And keep in mind, they didn't have our light pollution back then, so nighttime was way brighter when you looked up at the stars. So, you know, there's reason enough, plus a little nudge from the Holy Spirit, for them to go, a great thing has happened, clearly, we need to go see this. I mean, think about how often people travel even today to go see great, momentous things. You know, a new pope was chosen. Catholic people from around the world traveled all the way to Rome to be part of that big thing, right? They wanted to physically be there. It's one thing to read about Woodstock, it's another to have actually been there, right? We want to be where the thing is. So I don't think it's unreasonable that they would go off. Now, what do they do? Well, they go probably 800 miles. It's probably a month and a half of travel. They bring gifts. They find Jerusalem, but they find the city totally unaware. If you had gone to Vatican City and there was no party happening and nobody was in the square, and that would be disconcerting. We traveled a month and a half, spent all this money and time, and nobody in Jerusalem knows anything about the king of the Jews, not even the current king or the scholars. Uh-oh. You know, I mean, that would be a moment of discouragement, let's say, likely discouragement for them, which would explain when the star reappears how they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, it says. Like the Greek words kind of stumble over themselves at how happy they were. Wait a minute, there is a sign. This is happening. We didn't miss it. I wonder why Jerusalem has missed it. That's a different question. But the star does seem to have vanished. When you read what happens in verse 9, it says, after listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. All right, so the chief priests and the scribes went to the Bible to figure out where the Messiah, or the King of the Jews, was going to be born, and they go to Micah chapter 5, verse 2, and they learn it's in Bethlehem, and so they tell these Magi, obviously there's divine help here. Something told them that house, because you're not looking anymore for a manger scene, which was the sign the angels gave the shepherds. You're going to find a baby wrapped in swaddling cloths and lying in a manger. Well, that was months or a year or a year and a half ago. Now it's a woman in a house with a toddler, and there were lots of those around that time. So the star or something, an angel, a bright something, said this house. And so they were starting to expect some divine guidance here. The Lord was leading them. And they rejoice, probably thinking, wow, we're not crazy. We are being sent here on this mission, and something incredible has happened. Now, as we know, they worship. They actually worship him. And this isn't just what's due to a king or some dignitary, because they didn't do that for Herod at all. They worship this baby, and then they give these gifts, and then they return. They return home. They're providential gifts. Whether they knew that or not, we don't know. It was providential because that was the resources probably that this young family was going to need in the next chapter when they have to flee to Egypt from Herod. How are they going to afford to live? Well, they've got these very expensive gifts. They can live off of that. They're also providential in that the symbols point to things about who Jesus is going to be. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh speak to his calling, his specific mission. Now, I want to ask this question. Why did Matthew lead off with this? He's the only one to include it of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. He starts right in with this story, and he chooses to leave out the angels coming to the shepherds, And John doesn't include anything like that at all. He has a totally different thing. And Mark just starts right in with John the Baptist and Jesus's public ministry as an adult. No birth narrative whatsoever. He's the only one, Matthew's the only one to include this. And I think it's an evangelistic thing, actually. He is teaching us that the gospel is for all, but not all will receive it. I think Matthew's gospel is a manual for discipleship. It's inviting you to say, are you willing to follow Jesus? And if you are, here's how to do it. And it's laid out in a way that is very helpful to learn how to be a Christian. But he's giving a wake-up call to the Jews. Don't think because you're Jewish, you are automatically the people of God. A new thing has happened right here. And the Gentiles, symbolic through the Magi, are the ones that are being called to come worship this newborn king. And that's in the very beginning of Matthew's gospel. So the Jewish audience is primarily who he's talking to. In his gospel, there are over 60 direct quotes of Old Testament prophecy. And if you include the allusions, the references, the vague allusions, it's more than double that. So he had a Jewish audience, and he was trying to say, the gospel is for all people, and even for some who are unlikely. And Jesus is the new Moses. There is some interesting symbolism there. For instance, out of Egypt I've called my son. When Jesus goes into Egypt in the next chapter, fleeing Herod, there's the connection is made from the Old Testament days when they were in Egypt in exile. And then they go through the water of the Red Sea. Moses leads them through. Jesus goes through the waters of baptism. And then they're out in the wilderness being tested for 40 years. Jesus goes into the wilderness. He's tested for 40 days. And then Moses goes up on the mountain and receives the law from God and brings it to the people. Jesus, when he saw the crowds, went up on the mountain, sat down. His disciples came to him, and he taught. And it's the first block of teaching right there in Matthew 5. It sure looks like he is laying out the fulfillment of the Old Testament is in Jesus. And what Moses started, Jesus is fulfilling. In fact, Moses gave the Pentateuch, the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. They call it the Torah. Well, it's interesting that Matthew lays out his gospel in five big teaching blocks. The Sermon on the Mount is the first of five. And each one finishes with a formula. When he had finished these sayings, he blah, 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 went on and or whatever. When he had finished, that little phrase is in there five times after each one of the teaching blocks. Many people in the early church used this as a catechism. Not only was five symbolic of Moses, but you have five fingers. It was a mnemonic device to remember the blocks of teaching and what he's trying to communicate. This was a call to discipleship. I wrote right before Matthew, where you get, I have one blank page in my Bible, I wrote in there the five blocks: Sermon on the Mount, Mission Discourse, the call to be on mission, the Kingdom Parables, what is the kingdom like? Extending grace to people, and then the end times, when Christ returns, what to expect. Those are the five teaching blocks of this call to discipleship. So this is a highly logical gospel. I mean, keep in mind, he was a tax collector. This is an accountant. This is somebody who likes order and numbers. So there's a lot of balance in it. In fact, it's bookended with Gentiles, right? The Magi are right here at the very beginning, the gospel to the Gentiles. And then what is the very last verse, last three verses? Go and make disciples of all nations, right? All nations. Jews, it's not about you. It's about everyone. And he bookends this. He also bookends it with the reference, the King of the Jews. That phrase only occurs in two places. It occurs here, where they're looking for the one who's been born King of the Jews, and it occurs on an inscription on the top of the cross at the end. Surely this was the King of the Jews, right? The King of the Jews. Not this man said he was the King of the Jews. The King of the Jews is written there. So we've got a kingdom thing here, a call to discipleship. And really, with all of that as an introduction into this, I think the big idea is that the kingdom belongs to the unlikely. Notoriously, sinners. The unlikely who are the sinners, not the righteous. And we have a very unusual king. Consider Matthew and his own story, his own personality. And in Matthew chapter 9, he includes the calling of Matthew. His name was actually Levi, and Jesus changed it to Matthew, or he went by both. In chapter 9, it says, it's just very short, one little paragraph. It says, as Jesus passed on, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at a tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me," and he rose and followed him. And as Jesus reclined at table in the house, we learn from the other Gospels he's actually in Matthew's house. So Matthew invited him to come home, and others came as well. It says, many tax collectors and sinners came and were reclining with Jesus and his disciples. And when the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard it, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice, for I came not to call the righteous, but to call sinners." The kingdom belongs to the unlikely. A tax collector who's a sympathizer with Rome, who's notorious for being rich because he skimmed off of both ends. He didn't give everything to Rome he should have, and he took more from his brothers, the Jews, than he should have, and the tax collectors got rich and were hated by everybody. They were hated by the Romans, they were hated by the Jews. These are the people that were coming in. The kingdom was being received by these people, and Jesus said, "I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Matthew's gospel is an evangelistic call to discipleship. You know, I watched this week that old, I didn't know it was called this, a stop motion film. That's when you set up little figures and you take a picture and then you move them slightly and you take another one and you do it 1,000 times and then you play them in a fraction of a second and it makes a movie. That's how Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was filmed. And I watched that again, in particular, the Island of Misfit Toys, because I was like, okay, I love that idea. What's the theology of it? And there's a good and a bad to it, in a sense. It can be used with a very liberal message. And the message is this: you're actually not broken. You're just different from other people. Be true to yourself, and you will find out how precious and special you are. Which is the message of Rudolph, right? He had a big, red, bright nose, and he got mocked for it, and then it turned out to actually be an asset. He was better than the other reindeers because he could lead Santa's sleigh. Or take the Harry Potter story. You're just an orphan who isn't loved. Oh, no, you're actually the greatest wizard in the universe, and everybody's going to worship you. Like, that's actually the message there. And that's kind of the liberal message, is it's more about you're not as bad as you thought. However, when I looked at the Island of Misfit Toys, there was a train that had square wheels. Like, that doesn't work. There was a cowboy who was fixed to an ostrich instead of a horse. That doesn't work. There was a squirt gun that didn't shoot water. Every time you pulled the trigger, out came jelly. That doesn't work. It's not that they were just special or better because they were unique. They were actually broken. They were broken. And you know, Matthew's party that he had at his house was full of broken people. They were notoriously sinful. They were the rejects because of their sin. But they acknowledged it, and then they learned that Jesus came for such. That's the point here. The kingdom belongs to the unlikely, to the sinners, the ones whose heart is not right. They recognize their sinfulness, that they are not fit for the kingdom. The kingdom is actually for the people that recognize they're not fit for the kingdom. Isn't that ironic? And the Eastern churches celebrate Epiphany, January 6th, as their Christmas, not December 25th. And you can see why. You learn that Jesus came and these Gentiles were brought 800 miles by a divine providence to come worship as a symbol that the gospel is for all people, but particularly it belongs to the unlikely. And so they make that their big celebration. I would too. Now, let me point something out, that the king himself is unusual. So the kingdom belongs to the unlikely, to sinners, because the king himself is so unusual. When they get to Jerusalem, it's totally empty. Nobody's doing anything. They don't even know about it. He's born in such mean estate, as the hymn says, like in a manger. He's just an average person. And then he's rejected by his very people. And then he goes to the cross and dies for our sins. We are broken, and he's come to fix us, to heal us, to bear our burdens, to do what we can't do for ourselves. And so it's the ones who say, "I need a savior," that find the kingdom, not the ones who say, "I'm a basically good person," right? So this is really good news. Now, that's inspiring. when you recognize the kind of people that Jesus was appealing to who were coming in, and then it's painful when you look at the ones who should have come in and weren't. Why didn't those religious leaders go right with the Magi over to Bethlehem? Why didn't Herod? I mean, they had a different agenda. They were doing something else. So I think it's an inspiring thing to look at Matthew's gospel and to recognize that the kingdom is for unlikely people, those who are broken, those who are unfit for the kingdom. Those are the ones the kingdom is for. It's another one of those Jesus upside down things. The kingdom is just upside down from how the world works and how we're used to things going. And so that's great, because all you have to do is not admit that you're not good enough and try a little harder. You actually just have to say, I can't do this. So Lord, have mercy and help me. If you get to that place, now the kingdom is yours. That's good news. That's inspiring. But what do we do specifically with it? This is where I want to put something concrete on it as we come into the new year. So one, I want to say, seek the king. Jesus says this in that first teaching block, the Sermon on the Mount. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened. Ask and it will be given. Look at Matthew 7:7. Just look at the example of the Magi. First of all, they were open to guidance. Even if it was from an unusual thing they were looking at, they felt a nudge and they were open to it and they went with it. Then they inquired for help. You can't do this discipleship thing on your own. They needed help. So they go to the capital, they ask for help, they get it from the scriptures. They get directed by that help into the scriptures to find out the answer to their question. Then they worship him when they learn who he is, and then they give gifts of value. It costs them something, and they give to the king. That's a great picture of how to do this, how to seek. Specific, concrete, tangible. Be open to guidance, inquire for help of others, read the scriptures, worship Jesus, and give things to him. That's pretty good. And I would so seek the king is a concrete one, and I would say submit to the king. Herod resisted actively, and the religious leaders just ignored him. They resisted passively. They just didn't care. They weren't interested in it. And I want to say, submit to him by becoming a disciple. Matthew's gospel is a call to be a student, to start learning. That's why there's five blocks of teaching. If you are inspired by what Jesus has done and who he is, come into his school of discipleship. Become his apprentice. Become one of his students and learn. Be a disciple. We as a church have created a simple, concrete discipleship pathway. Worship, belong, serve, and make other disciples. You're going to hear next week all the different ministries that we've got launched for this particular semester. David, I hired him as our director of discipleship to help us reconstitute our small groups and encourage small group membership. You know, talking about inquiring help from others and being in the scriptures with others, maybe this is the year. Get in a small group with some other people, or take a class this time, or be regular in worship. Like, it's one thing to say, I need to worship more. It's another to say, I'm going to show up in that church whether I want to or not every Sunday unless I'm out of town. That's real concrete. And then ask God to help you with it. The kingdom belongs to the unlikely, to sinners. And we have a very unusual king. Let's talk to him. Would you pray with me? Lord, I thank you for the good news we have in this book. I thank you for your incredible grace that is so different than what we find in the world. Lord, would you help us this year? Would you show us some things that we need to change personally, each one? We know this is good news, but it is difficult for us. And so we thank you for your grace. We thank you for your patience. I ask that you'd give us joy like those Magi had in finding you. And I pray this in your holy name. Amen.